to stretch or move at all. Have a little bit of time if there's any questions arising from things I've spoken about or your experience in the day or anything you'd like to share about your day or reflect on in any way. So, you're very welcome. That's the case. Yeah.
There were many thoughts going through my mind earlier on. One in particular about women, it being International Women's Day, I thought it would be a nice thing to send special thoughts to all the women who have been exploited, enslaved, and subject to violence and injustice of any kind throughout the world.
So I just want to pause that one and say thank you for naming that. I didn't know that was the case, International Women's Day today, but just to kind of in a way echo and carry that, yes, and it's important to acknowledge, I think, where such forms of injustice, discrimination and harm have happened historically and do in the present day, and wish well for those who are subject to it. Yeah, thank you.
And you talked about the need for fierce compassion. And actually, your example with the fleas was music to my ears, because I've been feeling so guilty about killing moths, clothes moths. It's been a big thing for me for the last couple of years. I used to trap them with a glass and put them out, and then it became impossible. So now I just go like that without thinking, sometimes thinking, but making the decision that although I hate doing it, I'm going to do it anyway. And then apologizing. Anyway, and so this whole fierce compassion thing led me to wondering how that applies to classicism.
Is there a particular question with how it applies, or is it just a general?
Well, how do you respond to people you can't reason with? I've always been one to see both sides of some things and to feel for the persecutor as well as the victim. To think there's a story behind everything. I can't bring myself to feel in sympathy with classicists.
Okay. Well,
100%.
Okay. So, just to pick the pieces up, can people hear okay? Yeah. With... Not quite. Okay. So, well, there were two pieces there. One, first of all, was the fierce compassion being mentioned, and how that might apply to dealing with clothes moths and the fact of choosing to kill them. With anything like that, and, I've been involved in various discussions, conversations, whether it's from the range of how to relate to what we consume for our own nourishment in terms of food and the way that plays out, whether vegetables or animals or, I don't know if there are other options, chemicals, I guess, or with creatures, what's really important is to let oneself be fully aware of what one is doing and its impact. And if anything, to feel the sorrow, the grief. It's like let that particular cycle of karma actually turn fully in one. It doesn't mean that it's ended, but that's as... The more we can receive of the impact of our actions immediately, the less they amplify. That's my understanding of how that works. So to feel the sorrow and grief of the fact that, yes, this is my choice, and I'm not perfect, and I didn't say I was, and this is it. With regard to the choice of an individual to not use violence in any circumstance, which we might call pacifism. I think it's up to the individual. If it doesn't, something, it's not something you can agree with, that's fine. Or it's not your choice, that's fine. But what's interesting to me is if you have a problem with the fact that other people choose it. I don't know if that's the case, but it's pretty clear to me that we can choose what it is we're saying is most important. And we can choose to say what's most important from where what seems true to me is to not use violence, even if that means violence will be done to me or to someone I care for. And I remember being struck hearing the sort of the test was not sort of will you ever hurt someone even to protect yourself to be a pacifist, but will you stand by while someone hurts a person who you care about who you could prevent them doing it by the use of violence in some way or form. Yeah? And that's quite a big commitment. But for those who might make that commitment, I have an immense amount of respect. Personally, I don't know what my choice would be. There was a time in my early practice years where I thought, oh, I think probably that would be my choice, was not to harm anyone. These days, I'd have to say, I don't know. And I'm of the fortunate people of this world who haven't been called to make that choice. That's as far as I can go with it. But I think there is something powerful also in recognizing that the preservation of physical well-being or even life is not the only or the most important priority necessarily.
Well, when it's on such a grand scale as women getting systematically raped and enslaved in the Middle East and here, anywhere.
So what I hear is you feel moved to make a response, and your response might involve the use of force to protect someone
that's
vulnerable.
The only thing that can protect, stop that from happening.
So that's a valid choice. I'm not saying it's a better or a worse choice than someone else's choice. I don't know that I could say that. We each have to find our own. But I wouldn't say that someone who chose not to do that has necessarily made a bad choice. It really depends where you are in that.
I'm not judging pacifists at all. If anything, I feel judged by them. Where this came from partly is that I march regularly with the group that's attached to London Insight. I don't go as often as I used to, partly because of doubts, but for other reasons as well. But, you know, there is a part of me, it's not black and white, you know, I am a pacifist at heart. Mm-hmm. But there's a part of me that can't go along with that 100%. And there's a child in me that, you know, that when she was being mistreated as a child would have dearly loved to be rescued and never was. And so I identify with, you know, peoples, by extension, who might need to be rescued and are not. And we don't do anything. We just say, oh, what a shame, or how awful. And we don't do anything.
So when you move from the you to the we, there's a potential for, you know, difficulty in meeting. If you're finding it difficult that you don't do anything, then really it's important to find out what you can do and do it, even if it's only small, to find what you can do and do it. For other people, when you say they don't do anything, what you're saying, I think, is they don't do anything on the physical. Well, you mean we as a collective, but some of us do and some of us don't as a collective. There isn't a we there. But what I would say is don't discount what people do that could be described as inner action rather than outer. You and I don't claim to know, but we don't know what the effect of someone's inner choice is to stand compassionately but non-violently in a certain position. And if you feel yourself, and if it's actually the case that you're being judged by pacifists, then they're failing to be pacifists in that territory. Because judgment is a form of inner violence. And all too easily, righteousness starts to slowly kind of get a grip on what might otherwise be an ethical position. And it's really interesting. because righteousness is not an ethical position, even though it's often wrapped around ethical positions. Okay? And that's basically because it's very hard to be, you know, aware of that. But and so it happens. So, what I would say is that my grandmother in India was one of the women, the young women who sat down in front of the British Army, the maidens of Gandhi's, well, not just maidens, but Gandhi's pacifist movement. And it, you know, okay, so there's a lot of cases where that didn't work, but on that occasion, they actually met the might of the British Empire and actually turned it over. You know, there were costs involved, of course, but that gives me some hope.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, I mean, pacifism, non-violence wasn't inaction. That's the other thing to get really clearly. Non-violence is not inaction. And it's actually a very clear reflection also in terms of inner things, that acceptance, which looks like pacifism, or the inner process of making room and accepting things, is not inaction. It usually requires very actively to engage with our reactivity. And then to see what comes through when we're not in the place of reactivity.
I'm working on that too.
Yeah, probably we all are. So, I mean, it's a big topic there. Thank you for raising it. I'll probably put it down there. So we'll see if there's something else someone wishes to raise. But thank you, Dan. Yeah. I was saying yes, and just checking if there were other hands. Yeah.
It's a question straight reflection about like feeling the pain and like how to do that when the pain is like so great. And yeah, particularly like it's different when you're here and there's lots of people, but like at home when you're on your own, and yeah, the pain is so great. And, like, how do you
say that? So that's an important question to people here, in terms of being able to, and I've encouraged and invited a turning towards or an opening to, that isn't easy to sustain. And so one of the things you're recognising is that it's supported by the presence of others, and one of the things we need to do is seek out that support and contact. So it's not just once a month at London Insight. There are other ways it might happen. In terms of, I mean, that's one piece, looking for support, recognizing the need for it. But with any experience, part of the art of learning to open to it is to be able to recognize we have choices about how close we stand. Being open does not mean having to stand in the center of it at all times. It means being willing to acknowledge that it's there and, in a way, keep it within our field of awareness. But sometimes when things are really overwhelming or strongly intense, what we need to do is back off a little bit, give them some space. Part of what one learns in a meditative sort of training, and that's part of the journey, is to be able to acknowledge both what is difficult or painful in the field of experience, and then to see what's useful in terms of how close to be with it. So sometimes we actually need to say, be able to recognize out of compassion that actually this is more than I can hold right now. And it's okay to take a step back. Which is different than turning away from it. I don't know if that makes sense. There's something about it's here and I take a step back, or I turn away from it and in a way try to make it not be here. Which isn't very helpful, but is sometimes the only and the unconscious reaction, that's the way we actually get space from something as we cut off. But there's something about being able to back off. What I would suggest you do or explore, and this is what I found really helpful, is to check in terms of the physical experience how you're noticing the resonance of that which is difficult in the felt body sense. See how much space it needs. Give it space. And to ask, how close to this is it okay to be? And if you need to give it some space or to back off, to do so. I mean, I could say a lot more about how that actually works. I hope that makes some sense for you. Staying with does not mean having to stay that close or right up against. It sometimes requires that we give something space. And energetically, one can do that by actually opening the attention into a larger sphere. And sometimes consciously putting it down and saying, actually, I can't attend to this now. I need to turn my attention to something that's maybe more nourishing, uplifting, or supporting. And then I'll turn back and pick that up again when I feel resourced and able to. So it's even the putting it down and not including it is done intentionally and consciously as far as possible, with a willingness at such point in a time that I can handle it or feel I may be able to handle it better to turn back to it. So we can't actually hold all the things of the world in our heart all the time. It's not possible. We can't even hold sometimes just one if it's particularly difficult. And that's part of really honouring and respecting our limitations without judgment, without putting upon ourselves some idea of how it should be, to see what's possible here. So compassion in that regard starts with that kind of finding that balance within oneself. Not giving myself a hard time for where I can't actually open or hold or stay with. Okay. Thank you. So this will probably be the last one.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if there's a contradiction there, but the metta phrase is like, may I be free from suffering, may I be well. They feel a bit contradictory with the idea of accepting suffering. Mm. And I sort of invest them with the magic power of making me well and, you know, free from suffering. And but also, yeah, so I just wonder if you could talk about that, if there is a contradiction between...
I don't think there's a contradiction insofar as there's no contradiction between acceptance and the aspiration for transformation.
Mm.
Acceptance is to as things are, and as it is right now, it can't be different than this. But that doesn't mean that in the next moment it can't change. Okay? It's like this. There is the suffering that is right now. It already is, and therefore wishing it not to be doesn't help. It's not useful, it's not appropriate. But recognizing that it arises according to conditions, the suffering that's here now. My knee hurts. Wanting it not to hurt in this moment is pointless. In the next moment, I could say, well, actually, that hurts more than is okay. I'm going to do this. And oh, it doesn't hurt anymore. Interesting. Okay. Very small thing, but it's an option I have. Yeah? And so, with that, there's something about the way we relate in terms of time. That as it is right now is how it is. As it might be, or as it could be, in different conditions, is open to change. In fact, change is inevitable. It's not just open to it, it's unstoppable. And so, with wishing, in those kind of intentionalities of that kind of metaphrases, or the particular compassion elements in those phrases of wishing, the end of suffering. It's not that by that wish suffering will come to an end, but that by aligning or letting oneself tune into that wish, we actually tune into the caring that that's what it would wish for. That something in us would wish for it to end, because we care. And it's actually letting ourselves know that we care. Metta practice, or even karuna, compassion practice, isn't to make the suffering go away by wishing that it go away. It's actually to strengthen that part or that quality in the heart that cares about it. And allowing that strengthened capacity of the heart to then inform one's life. That's what is being practiced in that practice. It's not that if I say, may you be happy, that I'm expecting that as a result of that, you will be continuously happy thereafter. I would not be unhappy if that were the case. But it's not what I'm imagining is going to happen. But by doing that, I'm aligning my heart with the caring that is there for beings. In this case, you, it would be to say, oh, may she be happy. May you, or may I, or may we. So it's easy to struggle with that a little bit in the mind, and the idea of you do things to produce results,
mm-hmm.
that kind of materialistic mind. There's something true about it. There is a result, but the result is not necessarily that it changes how the world is. It more changes how the heart is. That actually does have an effect in the world.
I mean, there's some suffering that one could live without. You know, like just the self-hatred, for example. One could very feasibly...
You could imagine that it could come to an end.
Yeah, and that it has no real basis. So that kind of suffering, I can see, really, it's a valid wish to say, let's not have that anymore. Be free of that one.
Yeah. Well, you know, wasn't it? I think it's, is it St. Francis or someone else? You know, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. You know, that yeah, there's certain dimensions of what is difficult that we can't change. But we can nonetheless care about the impact of that. And that caring actually has an effect in our heart and in the world. Because not caring about it very clearly has, not allowing ourselves to feel the caring about it very clearly has an effect. And that effect is actually to amplify the suffering involved. Ultimately, you know that saying that says a problem shared is a problem halved? If you share the pain with all beings, you divide the suffering by such a large number that it gets to very close to zero. There's something like that that works in this. And I don't know if I can explain it much more usefully than that. The more our hearts and all hearts are open, it actually makes a difference. Okay. So I think we're going to need to finish there. Just a couple of minutes to five. A couple of things I want to mention. Just first of all, my appreciation and gratitude for you all and coming along and practicing today. To those people involved in the running and the organising of London Insight in general, and today in particular, also my gratitude and thanks for the good work and all the support that's come today and over the years. It's great that London Insight is very well and much going on here, it seems. Also just want to mention is I think probably most of you are quite familiar with the Dharma tradition here at London Insight and in the Insight Meditation tradition as a Dharma teacher. I feel very fortunate and grateful to be supported as I am through the generosity and kindness of people such as yourselves to live in such a way in that I don't charge for what I do, but I receive and trust in the generosity and the support of others who value this work as a privilege and a challenge in its own way. But nonetheless, something that seems to provide me what I need, which is fortunate, and also allows the teaching to be shared in this open-handed way, which I love and I'm very grateful for. And there's a box just inside the entrance into the dining room where offerings can be made and will be gratefully received. And there's something that I still find very touching about the way that in this tradition we have managed to hold to this despite pressures and times and different ways to do it differently, and that it's really lovely to be part of something that really flies in the face of the ongoing commercialization of our lives. And I don't just mean our, you know, material things, but the whole seems personal lives are becoming more and more commercialized. As I was sitting around a fireplace with some Canadians, in fact, it was in the bush in New Zealand, and one of them happened to work for Google. And it was very interesting getting his take on how they basically monetize information. And, you know, how people's personal lives have become just a source of income streams for a particular corporate operation. And it's like, gosh, you know, that's kind of sad. So it's, for me, kind of nice that not all of our world is going in that direction, and this is part of that which goes in a different direction. So thank you for being part of that. And I'd like to wish you all very well in your journeys and your lives. And may you all be free from suffering, from pain, and safe from danger in this life. Danger that is outer, and equally danger that is inner. May you all be well. So, go safely.